never see nothing like this again. California, I hope that it wakes you from all of the darkness that I couldn't break through. 'Cause I'm gonna miss you, I'm gonna miss you, I'm gonna miss you, I'm gonna miss you. Like I miss the ocean when I go to sleep. Like I miss the ocean when I go to sleep. Man, it's gonna break my heart.
Edford, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining me. Chuck Morse, right here at WMFO in Medford. And given that this is a live radio talk show, you're welcome to join us at 855-915-9636. That's 855-915-9636. We shall be joined shortly live in the studio by Chris Farone. He is the author of I Killed Breitbart, and a former columnist with the late Boston Phoenix. I think they went out about 3 years ago now. And kind of a reporter, commentator on, and, yep, okay, he'll be up shortly. Commentator on, he did a book about Occupy Wall Street. He did a book about, he analyzes the right, and he has a lot to say about this new so-called alt-right and its connection to Breitbart and Breitbart News. And I would imagine Steve Gannon, who is a main advisor to President-elect Donald Trump. I think he's his main strategist. And we'll have a good deal to say about the election, of course, and how we are all processing it, as it were. I know that there are certain people that I know in my own life who are having a lot of trouble processing it. I won't in any way deny the fact at all. In fact, I'm quite proud to be thrilled that we have a new incoming administration that actually is different, that does stand for the potential of real change, genuine progress, in my opinion. I think that this election was more than just an election of Donald Trump as a person and everything he stood for, which we'll get into, but it's also a repudiation of 8 years of Barack Obama. I don't think there's any way around that. And while I have no doubt that I hope and wish, as I think we all do, that President Obama has a successful retirement and that he enjoys all the benefits of life for him and his family. And at the same time, I think that President Obama will be given probably a few more awards and a couple of more accolades as he hopefully gracefully departs into the sunset, just like, in a way, our former Governor Deval Patrick. I would hope and I would imagine that he will soon be nicely forgotten and relegated to the corners of history. As we enter into a new administration, that even though they're not in office yet, so far so good. They seem to be appointing serious people to cabinet positions, people who are not there as political hacks, with one exception, and I'll mention that in a minute. People who are skilled, people who have ideas, people who are accomplished. That's what I expected from Donald Trump, whether you like him or not. If you take a look at his book, The Art of the Deal, you'll know that one of his skills as a businessman was to find talent and to then give that talent a lot of legroom to do what they do. And I think that if he can do that for the administration, then things are going to look very, very good for this country in terms of how we how our government functions. And so far, I think he's done it. The only exception, as I implied earlier, was the appointment of Elaine Chao to Secretary of Transportation. It's not that she's not skilled. It's not that she's not talented. It's not that she's not able. She is all of that. But we kind of overlook the fact that she's married to Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader. And in any case like that, it's kind of like, I don't know, a sort of a bribe, if you will. It's a bit of a, you know, I want to get along with the U.S. Senate. And maybe that's just how business is done, I suppose. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't want to be completely cut off from power. He knows how to function in that way. He knows that he has to, you know, in a sense, form solid links with the establishment in order to change the establishment. He can't come in as a complete outsider. We've seen what happens when a president does that. And I'd give the one example, that being Jimmy Carter. Even though Carter was, by most definitions, an establishment player, you know, he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a member of the Trilateral Commission, all of those things. Nevertheless, he did not in any way, you know, he kind of had an adversarial relationship with Congress and with Washington. And as a result, he got nothing done. So in many ways, while Trump represents certain ideals, and we'll talk about those, he's also a pragmatist who knows how to get stuff done, how to function. And for that, you know, I think that it's good news. I also have heard Trump criticized for being a bully, right? That maybe in the case of the carrier company, which decided not to relocate in Mexico, but keep in Indiana, and in the case of the Ford Motor Plant, what did he do? He bullied maybe the CEO in or made like some kind of a deal. Well, you know, I have to tell you, I think that that's a good leadership trait, right? I mean, that's how Lyndon Johnson operated, and he got a lot done, whether you liked him or not, and I tended to not like what he stood for, but nevertheless, he was an extremely effective president who got amazing accomplishments in terms of legislative reforms and legislative agendas and bills through Congress right in the first year of his presidency. And the way Johnson would do that would be he'd call somebody up, he'd get them into the Oval Office, he'd take them by the shirt collar, and he'd say, "You effing son of an F, you know, you're going to do this or I'm going to put you in jail," right? And then, you know, J. Edgar Hoover would come out from the side room with a little manila envelope, and he'd put it out on the desk, and there would be a picture of this guy in, you know, in bed with a hooker somewhere, right, or something, or there'd be like some bad news about his tax returns. And he's like, "Hey, you know, this is, yeah, you want to play hardball with us?" You know, so, yeah, I'm not suggesting that Donald Trump play that kind of game. But nevertheless, you know, in the real world, in the world of hard knocks, when you've got power clashing, and that's the nature of government, various interests which have to compete with each other, it's not a bad thing to have someone in a position where they should exercise that kind of power. So I think Chris Ferrone should be here any minute. He just called to tell me he was downstairs. So I hope that he's, I know that Jane said that she'd let him up. If I have to play music to go down and get him, that might be a problem because I'm not sure I know how to do that. But I might try. let's see. If I can call up Spinatron, maybe I could. Or what is it? The RDA Play? Maybe I'll try that. Let's see if there's any music on this channel. I don't think so. No. Nope. It's all silent. Well, I guess I'm just going to have to fly here and hope that that Chris is able to get in the building because I cannot, of course, leave dead air. Chris, if you're listening, maybe ask Jane to help let you in the door because I don't know how to leave the mic. I'm still very new at this, and the technical side of it is something that I should have learned better. And even though I did actually study it and pass the test, I still am nervous about it. I don't know quite what I'm doing. And so as such, I just, you know, this has never been a great skill for me, doing the technical side of things. So I'm hoping that if things do not work out, and we'll just have to reschedule it in 2 weeks and see what happens. But yeah, I'm not going to be able to leave the desk here. All right. You're welcome to join the show, 855-915-9636 is the number, 855-915-9636. Come on down. I do know how to take a call. So that's good news. Of course, you can check out my books. They're available at Amazon and Amazon Kindle. Just put my name in the server, that being Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code, and you will see about 15 books come up. I just finished a new manuscript that my publisher is, my editor, my literary agent is shopping around to publishers, and it's entitled The Age of Trump. I figured, what a better, if I can't get a book about Trump published right now, I don't know when, but it's a big book. It's actually 65,000 words. Most of it is not about Trump per se. It's actually the subtitle, which is The Right Wing Revolution. But I told my literary agent that I would wait until after the election to finish the book because I wanted to write about what I thought of the results either way. And, of course, when Trump won, I ended up writing 5 new chapters and then split the book into 2 parts, the first being The Age of Trump and the second being The Right Wing Revolution, which is more of a reflection on different experiences that I've had as a radio talk show host, as an author, and in politics, back when I ran for Congress in 2004 against Barney Frank. So I've revisited some of those things and looked back on it 10 years later. With some, you know, there's some of those things that happened back then were painful, and I've had a chance to reflect on it and consider it and put it into a format that is not about me, really, or about Barney Frank, but it has more to do with social and political issues that came up during that campaign that I think are relevant to think about today and what I learned from it, what my opinions are on it. And I hope that it's a good contribution to thinking. Anyway, back to the business of the election. There has been a great deal of, I don't know, consternation, gnashing of teeth, if you will, wringing of hands. People are literally disturbed. I've never seen anything quite like it. In terms of the level of disturbance over this election. I think that, yeah, I'd like to talk about that. I'd like to get some calls on it. What's going on? I mean, I could tell you even in my own life that it has been disruptive to my own family. My wife, my daughter, they're all supporters of Hillary Clinton. My parents-in-law, my wife's parents, they're way out on the left. They'll probably never speak to me again, which is fine. But my mother is upset. My brothers are upset. Everyone I know. I mean, these people are twisted with rage over this election. And I think that there are surface reasons for that, which I will discuss. But there's something much more profound going on here. Something much more fundamental to this question, and that is that I would argue that Donald Trump as a person, putting aside who he is as a person, which I don't think he's a very nice guy, but that's, you know, it's what he represents, is a major change in the way we are conducting our lives, our business, our government, the way we govern ourselves. It is possibly the biggest change since the election of Abraham Lincoln, or even since the election of Andrew Jackson, I compare it to. I think Trump is more like a Jackson-like figure. In that he really has come in and shaken up an establishment point of view. Now, whether he actually shakes up the establishment, I'm not sure he will. It doesn't matter. The point is, even if he completely sells out, the point is that what he represented was what people voted for. And there are some real issues around that. That resonated in a very deep way with not only American society, but with human society. People responded to certain principles that he articulated, however imperfectly. And I would argue, and I would suggest, that those principles come down to one simple thing. And there are a lot of other things that spin off from it. And that one thing is America first. Now, this might seem like to most of us people, us conventional types, people including certainly myself, the idea of putting America first is a normal thing to do. Of course you're putting America first. This is where we live. If this was Zimbabwe, we would put Zimbabwe first. If we were in, you know, Myanmar, we would put Myanmar first. But since we're in America, naturally we put America first because that's who we are. That's where we live. That is where our future lies. That's where our children will grow up and live the next generation. So, of course, we're going to put America first. We want to have control. It's a democratic idea. You know, it's a progressive idea. It's the idea of controlling our own lives to the degree that we can in this imperfect universe as imperfect beings who are subject to all of the vicissitudes of life. And whether or not we are going to also control our own destinies, our own futures. These are very basic elements of being alive. Of course we're going to put America first. We all assume that. And yet, it is an extremely controversial idea right now in the ethos and in the milieu in which we live. Because, in fact, it's safe to say that to varying degrees, recent administrations, with an acceleration of the tendency under Barack Obama, have not saw this as a virtue. They may occasionally give it some lip service, but fundamentally they do not think we should be putting America first. They think that by putting America first, somehow we're being selfish. Somehow we're not willing to do the right thing, which is sacrifice ourselves for the good of someone else. That's the virtue. That we should, in a sense, lower our expectations. We should dampen our economic growth. We should cut back on our use of energy. We should reduce our income. We should dampen down on our individual spirits, our ability to accomplish, to think on our own, to be individuals. Because after all, other nations are not as successful as we are, which is inherently unfair, according to this ethos. I'm not in any way endorsing this at all. In fact, I utterly reject it. But according to this ethos, there's something unfair about our being better off than other nations. And then, of course, you get into the Marxist conspiracy theory, which is that somehow the fact that we are better off than any other nation, and I'm not talking about, you know, some rich oil sheikdom like Abu Dhabi here. We're talking in general. That there must have been some sort of a malevolent reason for that. We must have somehow stolen our success from someone else. You know, Marx developed this theory of exploitation, that somehow our success can be explained by our exploiting someone else, some other nation, exploiting workers domestically. So it can only be explained in the sense because they view the ultimate virtue as absolute equality. Everyone has to be equal, even if everyone is poor. They hope everyone is not poor, but the practical result by any estimation is that everyone does become poor in such social experiments, with the exception of the ruling group of elites who call themselves the heroes of the proletarians and who technically don't own anything, but yet who live lavish lifestyles. I mean, take a look at Fidel Castro. Lived an extremely lavish lifestyle. Much more so than most American capitalists. In fact, his life would make most American capitalists blush. But this idea being that we are not to put ourselves first, not as individuals, not as a nation, but yet somehow put someone else first, as if that's somehow helping someone. And that principle has been increasingly expressed not by us as Americans, but by our ruling elites. And I don't mean ruling in the sense of a dictatorship. I just mean people in positions of responsibility. And that isn't just the government either. It's our mainstream media. It's our academia. In fact, I would suggest it's probably right here at Tufts University. It's this, our cultural arbiters, the sort of the movers and shakers in our cultural institutions are of believers of this principle, whether or not, of course, they practice it. They usually don't, like Castro, right? But they are advocating it, and they are taking steps to try to make it happen. High taxes, regulating businesses, and the nanny state, right? I mean, the whole welfare system is not to help the poor, not to actually help people in need, but to redistribute wealth so that everyone has something equal. Anyway, that's really the ethos that we're talking about here. And, the Trump election is a rejection of that ethos. It's that simple. It was a time to say, no, that's not what America is about. That's not what we are about as people. And the reason we're not about that is because it's not natural. It's not normal, if you will, for lack of a better word. The normal thing for the human being is to put yourself first. Put your family second, people that you love, people in your immediate circle, your parents, your children, your relatives, your friends, and then put your community third. That is the general normal pecking order of life. That is the pecking order that exists in nature. It exists in the animal kingdom, right? I mean, it exists in the plant kingdom. I mean, this is just the way it is. It's observable. And furthermore, in order to help another person or another nation, you have to put yourself first before you can do so. It's just the way it is. Otherwise, you're going to kill the golden goose. You're going to sacrifice yourself, and the other nation isn't going to likely benefit from it either. You know, there's the famous biblical nostrum, the most famous statement out of the entire Bible. Love your neighbor as yourself. Something the left likes to talk about, right? They like to trot that out. But if you'll take a look at the statement, what you see there, and what's not interpreted properly, is that you love yourself first. In other words, you're loving your neighbor as yourself, right? But in order to get to that love of your neighbor, you have to first love yourself. And so if you love yourself first and you're putting your own interests first, then, yeah, you can love your neighbor. You can help your neighbor. But it has to be from a position of yourself. And those are the positions that Donald Trump clearly articulated. And that is why he won. That is why his presidency, his administration, is a revolutionary administration. It shouldn't be revolutionary because these are the principles that this society is built on. These are the normal things. But it is and has become revolutionary because it is completely contrary to the belief system and the agendas of our ruling establishment, and that agenda accelerated under Barack Obama. And that's what's been rejected here. And that is why people are in such a rage. That is why people's heads are spinning. That is why people, I mean, you know, they're like doing, it looks like Linda Blair in the Exorcist. You know, they're spinning nickels and rolling on the floor. I'm sorry to be graphic about it. I mean, I could tell you about my own Thanksgiving experience. We went to family friends, people, very liberal people. And before we arrived, they let us know in no uncertain terms that this was to be a Trump-free zone. No discussion about the president-elect, right? These are highly political people. But we were not to talk about the fact that we have a new president-elect, like this didn't exist. This reminds me of, like, you know, what Stalin would do. I mean, he would airbrush out of the picture various people who had fallen in disfavor, right? And so I was like, okay, fine. I went, I had a great plate of food. I had a couple of glasses of wine. I kind of sat there. I mean, I said a lot more by not saying anything than by saying anything. And the rest of them, they just sort of, it was like very stilted, very kind of stiff. You know, you ever been to a social event like that where you just, you know, nobody kind of knew their place. Everybody was sort of like on edge. And it was very kind of dull. You know, nobody really, it was all kind of irrelevant, boring, small talk. And I didn't care. I had a couple of more glasses of wine than I might have and had a great turkey dinner. What do I care, right? But, you know, the whole thing is like, it is depressing, you know? Here we have the new government. I mean, look, I get the fact that people didn't support Trump in the conventional sense. Back 8 years ago, I was not a supporter of Barack Obama, did not vote for him. But yet, once the election was over, I was willing to give him a break. You know, I was hoping because I care about the future. I care about the country. I hope for the best. I hope it's not too terrible, if you will. You know, I recognize that there's, in this country, we generally, as a tradition, give the new president a honeymoon. Like maybe the first 100 days, you know, to sort of get his feet on the ground and sort of develop an administration. And then, yeah, sure, we form a loyal opposition, as we should. That's part of our job as citizens, especially conservatives understand that. Conservatives are never, or rarely, and if they are, it's an exception, but never are we worshipers. You know, people worshipped Obama. People never worship a conservative, ever. You don't see them on the cover of big magazines with, you know, the close-up of their face. And, you know, I mean, I remember when Hillary Clinton, for example, ran for the U.S. Senate in New York, the New York Times Sunday Magazine put up a picture of her with one foot straddling Manhattan and the other foot on New York State, looking up with that smirk that's etched into her features, you know, with a gigantic, like a Statue of Liberty-like pose. You'd never see that with a conservative. We don't do that. Conservatives are more interested in maintaining individual rights. They may applaud someone for accomplishing something or standing for the right thing, but always with a sense of wariness, always with a sense of like, this is good, but let's make sure that we preserve our individual rights. We don't worship government, right? But even having said that, I, like most conservatives, in fact, I don't think too many who didn't, supported the new president because I support the office of the presidency. I support the system. I believe in it. And I hoped and prayed that Barack Obama was successful because I want my country to be successful. And that, and when I say successful, I mean successful in what I view as success, which is freedom. I did not hope he'd be successful as a socialist. But I hope the country was successful. And let's just say, I hope that he wasn't too bad. And as it turns out, I don't think he really was that bad. He wasn't as bad as I thought he was going to be. I think things turned out okay, even though it was a fairly depressing 8 years in terms of how our government functioned. I think he had a negative view, just as I was saying about this idea of America First, something that he arrogantly and smugly dismissed. You know, he was asked about American exceptionalism, and he was like, oh, no, we're just like any other nation. That's nonsense. We are exceptional for the same reason that if I were a Belgian, I would view Belgium as exceptional. You know, this is the function of a sovereign state. So anyway, I think that Donald Trump articulated that idea very well. And I think he espoused political programs that would reflect that idea, such as his approach to international trade relations. He wants to make sure that our agreements with other nations regarding trade is conducted in a way that the United States uses our leverage as the biggest economy in the world to get the best possible deal for the American people, for American labor, for American industry, right? You know, American labor, I mean, this is something I don't understand why the left isn't on this. Well, I kind of do, but let me finish my thought here. American labor is such that they have worked for over a century to raise their standards. The union movement, which I'm a big supporter of, you know, the development of better working conditions, better pay scale, better involvement in the companies that the people work for. These things didn't just happen overnight. They happened over a century of trial and error and in many cases struggle. I think that Trump saying, hey, we have to continue to preserve those gains, both by working out better trade deals that protect the American industry that hire labor, and better immigration policies that protect the value of labor against the onslaught of cheap labor. Those are values that any nation embraces. And, you know, when we consider policies like immigration, the number one factor is, how is this going to affect Americans? How is it going to affect property values? How is it going to affect rental values in a downtown city if there's a major influx of immigrants? You know, how is it going to affect our culture? You know, the American culture is something that is of value. You know, people, the negative people in the Obama administration and the left, they want to use propaganda saying, well, if you're saying that American culture is valuable, isn't that a way of putting down the culture of someone else? Not necessarily. It's simply saying that for better or for worse, we have this, in a sense, amorphous and, you know, not easy to define thing called culture that has developed over centuries, goes back to the colonial times, that has integrated and assimilated other cultures that have come here, but on our own terms. You know, I mean, my grandparents, when they came to this country, they worked hard to assimilate and be American and to acclimate themselves. That's a virtue. It doesn't mean that they gave up their identity in their former life or their religion or their nation of origin. They didn't, actually. But they nevertheless put as their first value Americanism, right? I mean, George Washington discussed this in his farewell address, that while he admired the differences of Americans, and I could quote it, I'm not going to call it up, but I'll paraphrase, that while he admired and respected and wanted to preserve all of the different opinions in religion and in ethnicity and in manners and in ways of being for Americans in different regions of the country and newly arriving Americans, nevertheless, his hope And his prayer was that we would put America first, that we would put our identity as Americans before our identity as Catholics or Jews or Italians or African Americans or Hispanics or whatever. And when Donald Trump talks about putting America first, that's what he means, all Americans. I think he was clear about that. So there's the economic piece, putting America first in terms of our trade relations with other nations. There's the diplomatic piece in that we're going to be members of a group like NATO, but yet we're going to insist that it be more advantageous to our interests to do so. Why should we continue to pay, as taxpayers, enormous sums of money, and probably a lot more than we even realize, to maintain NATO for countries that can afford to pay it for themselves? I mean, I think that Trump is absolutely right about that, isn't he? And thus, there's a renegotiation. There's an insistence more, it's really not so much a renegotiation, but it's an insistence that the government maintain its position as is, that already exists on paper. It's simply that it's enforced. Anyway, welcome to join me, Chuck Morse, Chuck Morse Radio, here at Tufts University, Tufts WMFO Medford, 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636 is the number. It looks like Chris probably can't get in the building. I apologize, Chris, but I really can't leave the desk in the middle of the show. So what we'll do is we'll reschedule for my next show, which is going to be in 2 weeks. And maybe at that point we'll meet up earlier and get to the studio sooner so we can make sure that we make it happen. You know, radio is like, it's like getting on an airplane. You know, it's like getting on a train. Once it leaves the station, you're done. You miss the train. It's just, I'm sorry, it's the way it goes. I've been there. It's you know, it's not fun, but so be it. Let's see. Let me take a look at a PSA here. Walking is good exercise. That's a good one. Although other physical activities can provide a more vigorous workout, walking is easy, requires no special equipment, and is good exercise for most adults. In urban areas, walking can be an excellent alternative to driving or even taking public transportation. For example, it's just a little over 2.5 miles from the Tufts campus in Medford to Harvard Square in Cambridge, a distance that can be walked in about 45 minutes by a healthy adult. Walking can get you fresh air, exercise, burn calories, save you money, and with all the attentive and otherwise impaired drivers on the road, it's safer than riding a bike. A public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Community Radio. I'd say that's pretty good advice. I mean, I've actually been trying to increase my walking. In that, you know, now that I've just turned 60 years old, I'm hoping to have another relatively healthy 10 years. I feel like I have to do something, and so what I've done is on my cell phone I have like a walk. It actually counts the number of steps I take every day. And so I look at that and I try to, I mean, like I do with the, I have so many analytical things. You know, I'm looking at numbers of people who view my podcast and numbers of people who look at my blog site. And, you know, it's all the rest. And so I now look at the number of steps I take in the course of a day. And so, you know, I try to maintain ideally about 5,000 steps a day. And that means I might do a little extra walking here and there. Why not? I may go up a flight of stairs. I mean, I've even I mean, when I started doing it, I was a little silly about it. Like, I would walk down the stairs to get, you know, the laundry or to go to the basement. And if I didn't have my cell phone on me, I'd then go back up, get the cell phone, and walk back down just so I'd get credit. I mean, I'm not quite that obsessive about it at this point. But anyway, in the overall sense, whatever it takes, it's not a bad idea at all to do some extra walking. I mean, I don't think anybody would disagree with that. That's not controversial. 855-915-9636 is the number. You're welcome to join the program. 855-915-9636. Come on down. Getting back to my reflections on the election, I think the reason there's such angst is because this is a revolutionary change in the way we view our nation and ourselves, putting America first as a progressive idea, as a good idea. And I think Trump, by the way, has made it clear that when he says America, he means all Americans. I don't think he could have been more clear about that. And yet, the agitation, if you will, the agitprop, the propaganda, if you don't mind, from the left against Trump, against trying to stop this. And it was in many cases knee-jerk and in other cases quite calculated, was that by taking this position, putting America first, this is somehow proof that the person who possesses that idea has something against black men and women, has something against gay men and women, has something against Hispanic men and women, has something against whoever men and women, has something against women. And I think that that is an ugly, really nasty and despicable lie. And furthermore, it is a piece of agitprop that has been used self-servingly by the left to stir up racial and ethnic division, to create troubles. Look, everyone knows that this society has racial divisions. I mean, that's no secret. It's just part. It's the dark side of life. And we're the most multiracial, multiethnic society in history, maybe with the possible exception of the modern state of Israel. And as such, yeah, there are divisions. There are tensions that sometimes arise. It's complicated, you know. It's complicated enough having relationships with people if everyone's the same. But we are different. We have different subcultures. We have different, backgrounds, racially, ethnically, sexually, for that matter. And so, sure, there are tensions. It's just part of life. But if you want to exacerbate those tensions and create more division and more stark definitions of things, then you might have a little political motive to do so. And I think that's exactly what the left tried to do against Donald Trump by claiming that he's got something against people of color, mainly. And they're continuing on that path, even though he's been elected. It's almost as if nothing's happened. And they will continue it through every day that he's in office. They'll continue to hold up. And now they've got this pseudoscience, this micro aggression that I think has been brought about. Chris Ferrone's here. Hi, Chris.
Which one?
Why don't you sit right over here, Chris? Thanks for coming down. Sorry, I couldn't leave the mic, and I'm still new at this, Chris.
Sweating in the hall for a half hour. Is this a tactic?
Yeah, no.
Is this
no,
a tactic?
You
make people sit in your torture chamber?
Well, you know, I'm still new at the actual technical stuff, so I'm like, I was afraid to get up. Otherwise, if I knew what the heck I was doing here, I could have put on a song and come down and got you, but I couldn't leave the board. So anyway, Chris, you're the author of I Killed Breitbart.
Yes,
you actually interviewed Breitbart.
No. I got in the last big screaming match with him, and
just before he passed away.
Yeah, about a day before.
Okay, and now of course, I mean, we could talk about Andrew Breitbart. And also, I wanted to talk, I have a lot I'd like to talk with you about the Boston Phoenix, what happened there, all of it. Boston media, we could talk about, but I think we're kind of running out of time.
Yeah,
so
let's
talk a little bit about Breitbart and about the Breitbart site, because it's come into the news, obviously, during the campaign. Hillary Clinton made a speech in Reno, Nevada, where she talked about Breitbart news.
That full frontal definitely did not help put the kibosh on their hated website.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about, because she talked about the alt-right, which was not something I'd ever heard of until she mentioned it, and then I looked into it.
Well, you must not read Breitbart, then.
Well, I do, but I never heard the term.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's, well, there's a lot of people, especially if you go back, depending on the term alt-right, but as far as kind of like the whole environment around it, a lot of stuff actually started on 4chan, a lot of message board, video game culture. So I've been kind of tracking a lot of that stuff for years, covering Anonymous and covering stuff like that.
And then there's this Professor Gottfried, who started the whole alt-right thing in 2009. I just saw an article come over Tablet Magazine. I didn't even actually read it. I just glanced at it as I was coming over here. But I guess that from what I can tell, and it's only a cursory examination of it, and I know you're more of an investigative reporter, but it's what it is kind of like this new internet type of communication. You get a lot of bloggers. A lot of them have, you know, obviously have big mouths. And they sort of communicate in a more brash and less subtle way.
Well, yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of nonsense. And, you know, frankly, the reason people didn't care that I killed Breitbart, because in that constellation of kind of other sites that surround that site, there was a lot of, you could check it now, there's a ton of headlines. A lot of people actually thought President Obama killed Breitbart.
Right.
There were a number of.
I remember that.
And something with a coroner and Sheriff Joe Arpaio, like pick all of your favorite conspiracy theories, and they were all stirred into a pot. So that's, you know, you said new, and I know you mean relatively, but I think it's new to a lot of people now. And the mainstream media, I think it's probably one thing we could agree on, really has no idea what they're writing or saying or covering. So we see a lot of, you know, ham-fisted attempts to describe what the alt-right is, to trace it back. You know, everybody wants to find one person who coined the term, but this is a cultural thing that's been happening for a while. And, you know, this is, I didn't do any press when I put the Breitbart book out. It was absolute cancer. The left was as afraid of it as the right was angry about it. So, you know, I'm happy to rap about it. The book's available for free now, so.
There you go. And I've read in it, I read the first part, I read up to the part about James O'Keefe and Operation Veritas.
Well, that's where it gets into. That's where it becomes like a book. You know what I mean? Before that, it's kind of just me spewing. Me, I like to kind of get down and dirty and kick around.
Oh, I know. And you have that great Boston Phoenix writing style that I remember.
Thanks. You know, the alt. You know, we're the original alts. Don't forget the alt left. You know.
Exactly. I think that it's, you know, first of all, there was conspiracy theory around the death of Andrew Breitbart. He died suddenly. He was a young man. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with speculating about that. I think people are killed occasionally.
Well, I don't disagree with you. I just think that, I think it's worth noting that. I mean, these are the kinds of, a lot of these kind of, everybody's talking about fake news now. I don't know what the crossover line is, but a lot of these kind of, you know, there's speculation sites and there are news sites, and a lot of people confuse the two. That's fine.
Right, and I think that there are situations where someone can speculate when someone dies, whether or not there was a conspiracy. I don't think there's anything
Michael Hastings, for example, I don't know if you're familiar, Michael Hastings, he's my age exactly, so he would have been 37 now. He died at 33. He was a great reporter for Rolling Stone, wrote the big article about Stanley McChrystal that forced Obama to force him out of the administration and died in a car accident in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, pretty odd situation. You know, of course, you know,
you wonder,
but, you know, we didn't see certain, you know, whether it's a more conservative public. I don't even think you'd see like the New York Post kind of, you know, going after something like that.
While we're talking conspiracy, I'll get into a real right wing conspiracy. Tim Russert.
What about him? Was killed?
Tim Russert, interviewed during 2004 election both John Kerry and George Bush and asked both of them about their membership in the Skull and Bones.
Yeah.
And they both responded to his question with almost the exact same answer and almost the exact same expression on their face.
Well, they're both Skull and Bones, right?
Yeah, they are.
So what's the big deal?
Well, the big deal is that Russert brought this up publicly on a big national TV show that most Americans, I mean, you and I know about this, but most people had no idea.
How about all the gross, disgusting corporate interest that Tim Russert probably reported on over the years? Like, why would you think that it would be them instead of,
well,
you know,
I don't,
a Koch
first of all,
brother or something?
First of all, I don't think it. I bet I understand the theory.
Oh, I get you wackier stuff than that. We only have a few minutes left.
We do.
We can get into aliens and stuff.
Sure, but the point is, I don't think that, I think the point is that he made the public aware in general of the existence of this group called the Skull and Bones. People had no idea.
Well, unless they'd seen the Hollywood film, Skull.
Yeah, but you and I know about it, but most average American schlubs on the street didn't know about it until, and they're like, really? So we have both the Democrat and the Republican are members of the same. Anyway, that was a conspiracy.
We could trace that kind of conspiracy to, what, let's talk Goldman Sachs, the same kind of people, you know, same bankers working in both administrations.
It's true.
Obama and Trump administrations.
Well, you and I are on the same side on that one.
Well, then you would be the only Trump supporter that I've heard have a problem with that. I'm serious.
Oh, no, that's not true. A lot of people are having a big problem with it.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Bannon is their man, so I don't understand.
Well, I'm talking about the new Treasury Secretary, Goldman Sachs.
Okay, yeah, but I mean, Bannon spent how many years at Goldman Sachs? In the 8?
Right. I think with Bannon, I think it seems, and of course, it's always, when you're dealing with conservatives, they're always suspicious of everybody anyway. But at least with him, it seems like he moved on to his own thing, and he started like a hedge fund that bought like entertainment.
God's work.
Entity, what is it, Castle Rock?
No, I know, and he was involved in, Mr. Wannabe Film.
Yeah, exactly. So I think he kind of, and if anything, he's been, in Breitbart, he's been extremely critical of this sort of, and I want to mention this. I mean, he uses the same language that somebody like Bernie Sanders uses, or
Warren uses. Bernie Sanders wouldn't turn around and actually hire, you know, because I think some of the things that Bannon said about, what do you say, who was grown in a petri dish at the Heritage Foundation, that Paul Ryan was, that kind of rhetoric, you know, fantastic, but who's going to back it up?
Well, when I'm talking about rhetoric, I mean, he uses the same language about international banking and international corporations and their sort of informal influence and power. But when Bannon says it, and when conservatives say it, they're immediately labeled as anti-Semites. Whereas when Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders says it, and it's almost identical if you take a look at the language, it's seen as progressive.
All right, but I mean, if you're saying that the problem is that not enough conservative, I think the problem would be that you're saying that conservatives are afraid to talk about bankers because they're pegged as anti-Semitic?
I'm just simply pointing out that the main charge against Bannon when Trump asked him to be his strategic guy,
was that he's an anti-Semite, and it was based
upon these articles in Breitbart. But if you had those same articles under the byline of Elizabeth Warren, it would have been seen as progressive.
I don't think somebody calling a reporter a renegade Jew would have been seen as progressive by anybody.
No, but the point, by the way, it wasn't Bannon that said that, it was David Horowitz.
I know, and I do understand that the attribution of everything to a publisher is a little bit much. And listen, I got to be honest, I do think that it's worth noting some of the alt-right and anti-Semitism, but on the fact, I would love to see more reporting about the rest of his background, about Goldman Sachs, about military ties.
Sure,
you know. And
he had a very interesting career. And also, I will definitely concede happily, I mean, because it's the truth, that it seems to me that Breitbart does have some issues with sexism. This has been pointed out to me by my teenage daughter, that there's some real kind of hair-raising.
You mean like at the actual organization?
No, by their writings, particularly with this guy Milo.
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean, the guy's...
He's not really... I mean, let's not call him a reporter. He's
yeah,
a,
I mean,
he's
they, I don't know why I mean, they have him in there.
Well, because
I mean,
he gets clicks. That's what it's all about. And like, you know, you said the Bannon, Breitbart. This is people have to... One thing I like people to remember is that this is a Los Angeles institution, this is a Hollywood institution.
Sure.
So, you know, a lot of these guys dabbled in filmmaking. You know, Bannon's got a number of documentaries under his belt that he cleverly distributed through, you know, a bunch of different kind of sources. They mainstreamed it. So, like, this has been a long time coming. I've been watching it. So it's certainly interesting to see it shake out. And it could have been the other way. You know, if Bernie had ended up in the White House, you'd see perhaps somebody from a Mother Jones or a Nation, the right considers completely out there in the White House running something.
Well, that's my point. Breitbart is similar to on the left. You get Counterpunch, Alternet.
Yeah, you sure. We contribute to Alternet.
It's a new way of communicating. It's more like, as you say, they're chasing clicks. It's brasher. in a sense, the Boston Phoenix fell by the wayside because they didn't do this.
Well, you know, the Boston Phoenix, Stephen Mindich, technically, I mean, could have stayed in business. He lost, he's reported $1 million going glossy. And that, you know, that's a different time. It's 3 years. No, it's fine. I mean, don't take it as attack. Trust me. I was just a staff writer. You know, I was just sitting there, right. Got the axe like everybody else. But, you know, I run Dig Boston now. We're actually about to expand that in 2017. I run a nonprofit called the Boston Institute for Nonprofit Journalism. And we support not just the Dig, but more than a dozen local community newspapers, from the Dorchester Reporter to El Planeta. We publish in Spanish. And we go to these outlets and we say, what kind of stuff can you not afford to do because of the way that the media is now? And we do small investigation. We did one with the Watertown Tab about Boston police officers who were taking compensation for injuries that they apparently did not actually sustain during the shootout after the Marathon bombing. We've teamed up with El Planeta to do stories about politicians in East Boston. So, you know, we're really, you know, my focus, I'm always happy to wrap national stuff, but frankly, my focus is local. And, you know, one thing I can always agree with conservatives about is that the Democrats on Beacon Hill are doing nothing for us. You know, this is for me, it's actually very interesting seeing the national pissing match that's going on, since, you know, I'm really in a totally different mind state around here in Massachusetts.
Right. Okay, my guest is Chris Ferrone. Dig Boston, right?
Yeah, digboston.com or bingeonline.org. And I brought you a copy of my Occupy book, which kind of set the whole thing off. That's what I was fighting with Breitbart about.
Okay. I guess that, you know, you're doing what we expect, or what we used to expect reporters to do, doing hard investigations. Now, I think that's why Breitbart's really in trouble, because they have done that even on an international level. I mean,
what do you mean in trouble? They're doing better than ever.
Well, I don't mean that in that way. They're fine, but I mean in trouble in terms of being attacked.
They're running the government. Who's going to attack them?
I don't know. They're running anything. But the point is, they're very successful. It's huge, but they're being vilified, let's put it that way, mainly
but that gets them more clicks and more advertisers.
You're absolutely right.
Countless ads for people. Hey, did you shoot someone? You know, listen to the podcast attachment. Did you shoot someone? Here's how you get off. Like that. Those kind of things. Everything they stand for brings them more money. So I don't see them as being attacked. I see that.
I agree, but they're being. And I think the left is making a big mistake by continuing this kind of campaign of vilification.
Now, because that I almost agree with.
Okay, because all it does is.
It's just noise. It's noise, and it's
not well founded. But they've done some very hard hitting things in terms of like investigating Barack Obama. They've investigated Hillary Clinton. They broke some stories.
But it's
going
the boy who cried wolf. I mean, they've also, you know, published James O'Keefe's stuff, which James O'Keefe had to pay $100,000 in restitution to the people who ended up getting laid off. Shirley Sherrod. I mean, we're talking about doctored videos. And listen, NBC does it too, that. Proudly say no news organization I ever worked with, you know, has been accused and, of course, found guilty in court of, you know, chopping up. I mean, it's despicable, some of that. So I think, sure, they've done some good work on Barack Obama, maybe, but it's the boy who cried wolf. Who the hell is going to listen outside of their bubble? And that's why I really strive to get outside of my bubble.
They are, people are listening outside the bubble. And that's why they're there's an attempt to try to, marginalize them and discredit them. Now, you mentioned James O'Keefe. You did a good job in your book exposing some of his
serious sexism issues.
Yeah,
with
his corruption, his personal life, his, you know, certain things that are really unsavory. However, he has done some amazing things. He's done reporting that is what we used to expect 60 Minutes to do.
I don't think anybody ever expected 60 Minutes to pretend they dressed up like a pimp.
That's brilliant.
But he didn't actually do it. It was a lie.
Well,
you know
maybe
that, right?
It was a lie, but the point is...
But he's also done,
we can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. He has also done some amazing things. In 2014, he did some amazing videos that demonstrated voter fraud. And more
I know some of them, but yeah. Okay. I mean, he's breaking into Mary and Landry's office.
No, that's bad. But in one case, he actually got this congressman's son was on record talking about extensively about voter fraud. We're reaching the end of the show.
I know what you're talking about. James O'Keefe wanted to spend all his time busting the privileged sons and daughters of spoiled politicians, that would be great. And I'm just saying a lot of his work is fraudulent.
And more true, but more recently he exposed that whole thing with Creamer and is getting paid by the Clinton campaign to engage in like stuff, you know, street stuff. Anyways, we've got
Break the box
coming up I'm trying to figure out. I'm very new with this. How to check out? can you do that for me? Thank you very much.
No problem.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I shall return in 2 weeks.
Thanks.
We are live outside the home of Joe and Rosie Goddard, where a pretty big tickle fight broke out just minutes ago. Sources say their father instigated the laughter. Let's go inside for a comment. Apparently, they have no comment. Dads, let this be a reminder that it only takes a moment to make.